All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest edition. The camera is working and my microphone is on, so we're already off to a better start than last week's show. Thank you to all of you who are tuning in. If you're here and you're thinking, man, you know, I don't think I can stay for the entire show, do not worry, because the full show will be posted here on YouTube and also on all listening platforms such as Apple Podcasts and Spotify after the conclusion of the show. I've got a great show lined up for all of you today. A lot of talks on quarterbacks. A lot of talks on quarterbacks today. Who's going to be the best rookie quarterback? Also, I'm going to talk about Pete Carroll, head coach of the Seahawks. He had a lot of interesting comments to say about a current quarterback on his roster. And also, what second-year quarterback is poised for success? And to follow all of that, our guest coming on later will be Steezy A. Smith. I will be bringing him on to talk about some NBA and NFL topics also. More specifically, what will the Seahawks do with their quarterback situation? He covers the Seahawks a lot. He lives up there in the Seattle, Washington area, so I will want to talk to him about that. I'll also, of course, be ending the show with the biggest winners and biggest losers of the week. But before we even get into any of that, I want to say, wow, the Miami Heat came to play last night. The Miami Heat showed up and reminded everyone, all the doubters and everyone watching, why they were the number one seed in the Eastern Conference this season. The Heat took Game 5 last night and took back control of the series with a commanding 35-point victory over the 76ers. The thing is, I'm not exactly sure if it was a great performance by the Heat or if it was a terrible performance by the 76ers. Seven Miami Heat players scored in double digits last night, while only three 76ers players scored double-digit points. The Sixers' leading scorer was Joel Embiid, who only scored 17 points. Last night, it was just a complete show of how much more physical and how much more Miami wanted to win this game than the 76ers. They were flat-out out-hustled in almost every aspect. The Heat won the turnover battle. They out-rebounded Philly. They outscored Philly in the paint. They certainly outscored them off the bench. Almost in every gritty aspect you could imagine, the Heat were the better team. That's how the Heat play basketball. It's not pretty. They have no superstars whatsoever, but that's how they win games. Defense and being physical, out-grinding you. There is a superstar on Philly, though, who I think is wildly underperforming. That would be James Harden. Last night, in a must-win Game 5 situation, James Harden had 14 points, 6 rebounds, and only 4 assists to go along with 4 turnovers. This comes after everyone, including myself, was thinking, he's back! James Harden is back! He is returned after dropping 30 points in Game 4 and going 6-for-10 from behind the arc, on top of scoring 16 points to close out the game in the fourth quarter. Everyone was like, Harden's back. He turned back the clock, and this is the James Harden we were waiting for. The fact of the matter is, he's not back. James Harden is gone. We need to let go. James Harden is no longer him.
You are not him. You are not him.
He just is not the same guy that he used to be. And now, Philly is going to be faced with a tough decision on their hands as to what to do with James Harden. James Harden is going to be eligible to get the Supermax extension that will pay him $270 million over the next 5 years. Should they pay him that money? I feel like the answer is absolutely not. If James Harden receives that Supermax deal from the 76ers, there is a good chance that that might end up being one of the worst contracts in the history of the NBA. If they were to give James Harden that contract, the 76ers would owe him $61 million when James Harden is 37 years old. Think about it. He's already washed. He's simply not even remotely close to being as good as he used to be on the offensive side of the ball. And defensively, he already wasn't much to talk about to begin with. At this point, James Harden is nothing but a facilitator at best. And honestly, he's not a great one for that matter. It's not like he's a Chris Paul level facilitator. James Harden is an average to above average facilitator at best, which is okay, but is it worth $270 million? Plus, not to mention, Embiid is going to need a deal comparable to that, if not more than that. We all need to let go of this idea that James Harden is still a premier player in the NBA. He simply is no longer what he used to be, and it's become extremely evident in this series against the Heat. Embiid was injured, and he missed Games 1 and Game 2. Now, you would think James Harden would be able to step up. This is the guy who wants $270 million. Okay, you need to take at least one of these two games. And he didn't step up. James Harden went completely missing in the second half of both of those games. You can't give a guy a supermax contract who can't at least put the team on his back for one game and get you one win when you absolutely need it the most. Also, not to mention, the Miami Heat are probably sitting back and saying, wow, we absolutely dodged the bullet for not trading for that guy. Because they were in talks with Brooklyn for Harden initially, and they ended up obviously not getting him. Sorry, Harden. I just don't think that you've shown enough that you have enough left in the tank to earn this Supermax extension. Now let's talk about the rookie quarterbacks of this year's draft class. This year had to be one of the most interesting quarterback classes in recent memory. Nobody wanted the quarterbacks. The most important position in the NFL, and teams viewed these prospects as afterthoughts. Reasonably so. None of these quarterbacks really stood out whatsoever. And in quarterbacks, and in honestly any prospect, you look for two things. Physical ability and on-the-field production. None of these prospects had both of these qualities. Kenny Pickett had great on-the-field production. However, there's nothing really physically great about his game that sticks out. Malik Willis is the complete opposite. Physically speaking, he has the highest ceiling of all of these rookie quarterbacks, but he's so raw that it might be a while or even a few seasons before he's even ready to step foot on an NFL field. Desmond Ridder, same thing. He's so raw. He won a lot in college comparative to the team that he played for. He came up big in some big games, but also benefited from an easy schedule, and his play was still inconsistent. He's athletic, but doesn't possess a lot of grade A level attributes physically. Here is my bold prediction of the week. For the first time since 2007, no rookie quarterbacks will start in week one of this season. The Steelers paid Mitchell Trubisky a good amount of money, and I think he will capitalize on his opportunity and win the starting job in Pittsburgh. In Carolina, Matt Rhule is desperate to win games and save his job. So no matter how bad Sam Darnold is, I highly doubt that he will stick a third-round rookie quarterback out there in Matt Corral week one to go try and save his job. And the Titans obviously have Tannehill to start over Willis. And then in Atlanta, they signed Marcus Mariota in the offseason to start, not to ride the bench for your third-round rookie quarterback. What's interesting about this year's class is the fact that these quarterbacks were drafted so late. They could never start a single game for any of their organizations, and it's not the end of the world, let alone them ever having to start in week one. In fact, to double up the bold predictions of the day, out of the top five quarterbacks drafted, so Kenny Pickett, Desmond Ridder, Malik Willis, Matt Corral, and Sam Howell, and yes, I know Bailey Zappe was drafted before Sam Howell, but that's okay. I'm excluding him from the discussion because under no circumstances should he ever start in an NFL game. I don't even know why he was drafted. That's just poor drafting on the Patriots part, which I got into a lot last week. But out of all those top five quarterbacks, there will be at least two, maybe even three of them who never start more than five games in the NFL. I truly and honestly believe that. Why? Because none of them are special. None of them are special quarterback prospects. And in order for you to last in the NFL at the quarterback position, you need to possess something special about you, something that you do that is elite, something that makes you different. At the end of the day, none of these quarterbacks have any of those traits. I just see a bunch of average quarterbacks. And nowadays in the NFL, the average quarterback is the backup quarterback in the NFL. Look at the quarterback talent in this league. Baker Mayfield has won a playoff game, but he's average, and now he's going to be a backup somewhere. Jimmy Garoppolo led his team to a Super Bowl appearance in 2020, almost beat the Chiefs in the Super Bowl, but he's average. So his team decided to trade up in the draft and to take a quarterback with more upside. Gardner Minshew. Every time Gardner Minshew gets a chance to start, he actually doesn't play bad, but there's nothing about him that's special. So that's why he'll never get a job and he'll never get a starting job in the NFL. I could honestly make an argument that Gardner Minshew would have been at least the second quarterback taken in this year's draft class if he came out of college this year. And he's going to be a career backup. So what are my thoughts on the rookie quarterbacks this year? They're all mid. And as I've said on this show now, since 2020, since the beginning of this show, you can pull up the receipts. The average quarterback no longer cuts it in the NFL. The average quarterback is now the backup quarterback in the NFL. Now, there was a team that was expected to take a quarterback in the draft, and they didn't. That would be the Seattle Seahawks. Pete Carroll said this week that the Seahawks will not sign any veteran quarterbacks, and he spoke about one of my ex-loves, Drew Lock, and he had high praise for Drew Lock. Pete Carroll says that he has no hesitation in saying that Drew Lock would have been the first quarterback taken in this year's draft. He also went on to rave about the physical gifts in which Drew Lock possesses at the quarterback position. I'm so glad about this. When I saw that Pete Carroll said that this week, I couldn't wait to bring this up on the show. I'm so glad that now I have an excuse to rave about Drew Lock. I now have an excuse to sit here and geek out over Drew Lock again, just to be vastly disappointed the moment he touches a football field in September. So let's go. Drew Lock hype train is just now officially open for business, and I'm immediately joining in on it once again. Pete Carroll is 100% correct. Drew Lock would have been the first quarterback taken off the board this year with no question. Drew Lock is 6'4" with a bazooka arm. He also has the ability to make off-platform throws, which is something that all scouts in the NFL look for. He also played against tough defenses in college at Missouri, playing in the SEC. Drew Lock has a special level arm talent. He really does. He also went 4-1 in his first five games as a starter in the NFL. When he came in, the team looked different those first five games as a starter. Sure, listen, was I wrong about him being a dark horse for MVP in 2020? Absolutely. I missed on that. But I was never wrong about the talent in which he possesses. I don't know how you could deny that. Drew Lock is kind of a Jameis Winston level quarterback, where if he could cut out the bad decisions and bad reads and stop turning the ball over, he could be really good. But the problem is that he's still a prospect, but maybe a change of scenery will help him. Seattle has put pieces around him. The offensive line won't be great, but after the additions that they made in the draft, it should be much improved. They still have DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, and a pretty decent backfield with Rashard Penny and Chris Carson if they could stay healthy. And guess what? If Drew Lock doesn't work out this year, nobody cares. You draft a quarterback next year in a class that is expected to be much more talented at the quarterback position than this year's draft, and then you move on. Nobody will care if the Drew Lock experiment doesn't work. What the Seahawks are doing is brilliant. Don't waste draft picks and salary cap on Baker Mayfield, and don't waste draft picks on a quarterback who you aren't 100% confident are an upgrade to the current quarterback that you have in place on your roster. I think the Seahawks are handling the quarterback situation perfectly, better than they could ever possibly imagine. They're staying patient and working with what they have rather than jumping the gun on a quarterback that they don't really believe in just because it's a quarterback. That is a sign of a good organization, one that is patient and one that has a plan. Seattle has always been well run, and it's being evident in the transition of how they're handling after Russell Wilson. Now let's talk about these sophomore quarterbacks. Why don't we? Last year's draft class was nothing like this year's. Five quarterbacks were drafted in the first round. And also, Davis Mills got some starting action last year as a third round pick. A lot of them had a very shaky and rough rookie year, which in recent history is bad news, but historically is actually quite normal for rookie quarterbacks who are transitioning from college to the NFL. This week, Pro Football Focus released their top five sophomore quarterbacks based off their situations on their teams. So I decided to make my own rankings. Here are my top five quarterbacks going into next season based off how I think they will play. At number five, I have Mac Jones. Mac Jones became vastly overrated in the beginning of the season. He really isn't anything special. Sure, he's fun. He's got a great personality, but as far as what he does on the football field, meh. For a rookie quarterback, he played great. I'll give him that. The only thing is, I feel like we've seen the best of Mac Jones already. He's already hit his ceiling in the NFL. He doesn't have the physical gifts and tools to ever improve to become marginally better than he already is. And to feed back into my point earlier, if you're an average quarterback in today's NFL, you have no place on the field but the bench. Teams now have a full year of film on Mac Jones, and he also lost his offensive coordinator in Josh McDaniels, so he's going to have to learn a brand new offense, which never, ever works for sophomore quarterbacks. Just ask Baker Mayfield. Now at number four, I have Davis Mills. For anyone who wants to debate me on Twitter, I am going to say this, and I mean it. I will stand by it. Please at me on this. Please at me on this. I mean it. Please do. Davis Mills was the best rookie quarterback last season. He had the highest passer rating out of any quarterback in the league in the red zone. So when the windows got tighter and the moments got bigger, Davis Mills stepped up and had the highest passer rating in the red zone last season, which is great. That's incredible. He also was in possibly the worst situation out of any of these other sophomore quarterbacks last season. Mills showed a little bit of promise in his rookie season, so much that it looks like he's going to get another chance to start this year. However, I can't put him higher on this list because one, the Texans are still going to be horrible. That offensive line is still going to be bad. Outside of Brandon Cooks, they also don't have a legitimate option at wide receiver on the team, and they have no reliable running game. Also, secondly, they're going through yet another head coaching change. And again, while I love Lovie Smith, I'm very weary of second-year quarterbacks going through a coaching change because sometimes that can make their second year just like their rookie season 2.0. And it really can hurt the development of young quarterbacks. And also, lastly, while I love Davis Mills and Mills Mafia is very much alive and well, Davis Mills also falls under one of those quarterbacks where what does he have that's going to separate himself from the rest of the competition in the NFL? As of right now, he falls under that average category. And if he has another average year, the Texans might be looking for a new quarterback next offseason. Now at number three, I have Trevor Lawrence, the golden boy. But yet again, another coaching change in the sophomore season. But the difference with Trevor Lawrence's coaching change is that Urban Meyer was just so horrible as a head coach, like a complete dumpster fire as a head coach in the NFL, just a complete utter disaster in Jacksonville, that bringing in Doug Peterson is going to be such a marginal increase at the head coaching position in Jacksonville. So even though it's almost never a good thing that a team changes coaches while trying to develop a young quarterback, in this case, it was actually essential for Jacksonville to find a new head coach. But they also made a great choice in this hire. Doug Peterson, the former quarterback, he was the head coach of the coaching staff that had Carson Wentz looking like Patrick Mahomes before Patrick Mahomes. He was also the head coach in Philly of the team that beat Tom Brady and beat Bill Belichick in the Super Bowl with their backup quarterback. Doug Peterson is no stranger to having to make do with the players in which he is given. What's going to hold Jacksonville back, however, is that their GM, Trent Baalke, has totally folded this offseason. I personally think he missed on the number one pick and the rest of the draft for that matter. They also paid huge money for Christian Kirk, a wide receiver who has never caught for over 1,000 yards in the NFL. But he did do a good job by extending Cam Robinson, the left tackle, and signing offensive guard Brandon Scherff to try and help protect Trevor Lawrence even more. I just wish that they would have done more in the draft to try and address those things. Draft offensive linemen, draft receivers to help Trevor out even more. But at the end of the day, the Jaguars upgraded at offensive line and upgraded at head coach, which I think are two extremely big factors that will help the incredibly talented Trevor Lawrence improve in his sophomore season. Now, at number two, this is going to come at, as maybe a surprise. I have my guy, the man I spent all of last season ranting and raving about, Trey Lance. That's right. I haven't lost hope in the big guy just yet. Look, we all know that Trey Lance was going to need some time in the NFL. That's why San Francisco was the perfect fit for him. He got to sit most of the year and learn the offense behind Jimmy Garoppolo. And he also got a little bit of experience in the games as well. Now, granted, when given those opportunities to play, Trey Lance did not look all that spectacular. And now there's some grumblings out of San Francisco that say the coaching staff is not really impressed with the improvement and the development of Trey Lance to this point. My counter argument would be this. He isn't supposed to be impressive yet. He was supposed to be a little bit of a project with an exponential amount of upside. I believe after a full offseason of preparing to be the starting quarterback for the team, Trey Lance will blossom in that 49ers offense. Trey Lance also doesn't need to learn a new offense. And on top of that, he's inheriting a team that was already in the playoffs last season. That is the perfect situation for a young quarterback. So with that being said, I cannot wait to see Trey Lance showcase his talent next season and show the world how incredibly gifted he is and why the 49ers traded up to third overall to draft him in 2021. And now at number one, that's it. I'm hopping on the Jets and the Zach Wilson bandwagon. Robert Saleh said this week that Zach Wilson was looking beefy, so I'm in. That's all the convincing I needed. He's looking beefy. Let's go. But seriously, even though the Jets were terrible last season, it's okay because they were supposed to be horrible. If you honestly expected the Jets to be good last year, then you're delusional. Honestly, like if you expect the Jets to still be good this year, you're still delusional. But I do expect Zach Wilson to improve exponentially and look way better than he did last year. One, he doesn't have to deal with a coaching change. The same offense that he learned last year will be the same offense that is in place for him in year two. Now at number two, the Jets nailed the draft. They now have a cornerstone piece on the defensive side of the ball in Sauce Gardner and another go-to wide receiver for Zach Wilson to throw to. Garrett Wilson and Elijah Moore are going to be a super exciting young wide receiver duo to watch. And I'm extremely excited to see how they will be used in this offense. And thirdly, Zach Wilson, despite a completely disastrous start to the season and almost a completely disastrous season that he had in New York, he still fought every single game. And not only that, he improved a lot as the season went on. In the first six starts of his career, he threw 4 touchdowns to 9 interceptions. Abysmal, awful, granted, out of the second overall pick, that is not something that you want to see. But to finish the year, in his last 7 starts of the season, he had 9 total touchdowns and only 2 interceptions. Given the circumstances that he was in last season, that's a pretty big improvement. I expect that improvement to continue in his second year in New York. Now it's time for me to bring on my guest, Steezy A. Smith. So basically, here's the story with Steezy. He lives in Seattle, in the Seattle, Washington area, like I had mentioned earlier. I live in the South Florida area, so it's quite literally coast-to-coast distance between us. Wink, wink, hint, hint to those of you who know. To those of you who don't know, you will find out later on. And I was not about to make Steezy wake up at 7 a.m. to join this show live with me, so I had to pre-record his segment last night. So don't be confused when all of a sudden I change outfits. But Steezy brought up a lot of good points and a lot of good takes in our conversation. So without further ado, here it is. Here he is. Here is Steezy A. Smith. Steezy, thank you for joining in. How you doing today?
Man, I'm feeling blessed. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling wonderful. Thanks for having me on, bro. How you doing?
Of course, man. It's always great having you on. I'm glad I finally got to after all this time. It's been way too long, my friend. I want to talk about the Seahawks later on and talk about some of the interesting stuff that has come out about them and the things that Pete Carroll have said this week. But let's talk some NBA first, because these NBA playoffs have been fantastic and extremely interesting, to say the least. Mm-hmm. On Tuesday night, the Celtics were able to come back from behind to win in game four, and they tied the series at 2-2. This series has been extremely back and forth. What do you think Milwaukee needs to do better to get back on track in game five? And who do you think ultimately will end up winning this series?
Man, first off, bro, I got to say, for Milwaukee, they just have to be more efficient from the floor. I mean, we're looking at their two best players, right? Giannis Antetokounmpo, Jrue Holiday. Giannis Antetokounmpo is averaging 32 points a game, which is great and all, and I expect that from the best player in the world. But 43.9% from the field throughout the course of the series, that is not going to get it done. I know in game one, he was very inefficient. He had a triple-double, and Milwaukee was able to overcome that. Jrue Holiday had a solid performance, but he himself, I mean, my goodness. What was the stat that I wrote? 31 for 92 from the floor, 33.6% from the field. And I understand, you know, he has had a heavier workload just because of the absence of a Chris Middleton, but there is no way you can get by with that sort of inefficiency, not against a top defensive team like the Boston Celtics, who haven't been healthy all series long. Keep in mind, in game two, the first game that they won, they didn't have the reigning defensive player of the year in a Marcus Smart. Game four, another game that they won, they didn't have Rob Williams, who was their best rebounder, best interior defender this year. And so I think it comes down to Milwaukee's two best players not only being more efficient, but, man, Grayson Allen, one of Grayson Allen, George Hill, Pat Connaughton also had to step it up. They've been okay in spurts, but they have to be more consistent. And I think last but not least, Giannis has got to make his free throws. I mean, we saw in the NBA Finals last year, he was improving in that regard, even throughout the course of the regular season this year. He was a much improved free throw shooter. But what's the percentage that I have? 60% from the free throw line throughout the course of the series. He's been missing clutch and key free throws in the fourth quarter of games, in the final, in the closing couple of minutes of games this entire series. That's not going to get it done, especially when you know that your second best player, your three-time All-Star in a Chris Middleton, is not going to be here for the next – honestly, for the duration of the series. And so knowing that he's not going to be there, you're going to have to make the most of your opportunities, you know, at the free throw line. You're going to have to be more efficient. You know, one of the other role players, Grayson Allen, Pat Connaughton, and George Hill, one of these guys is going to have to step up. They lost at home. And so now they're going to have to steal another game in Boston to kind of take back home court advantage. But all that being said, I stand by what I say. And before the playoffs even started, I had the Milwaukee Bucks going all the way to the NBA Finals, and I had conviction in what I say. And I know it's looking kind of tough right now. We don't know if Chris Middleton is coming back. Presumably, he's probably not coming back, but I still got to stick by the reigning defending champions. You know, right now, it's a best of three series, and I'm willing to ride with the best player in the game and Giannis Antetokounmpo. I know that he definitely has to be fired up, especially seeing how Al Horford just went off last game. I mean, oh my gosh, 30 points, 8 rebounds, and that dunk on Giannis Antetokounmpo. Giannis is definitely going to be fired up. He's not going to let anything slide come game five. And so at the end of the day, ultimately, I think Milwaukee prevails in 7-4-3.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Listen, when you have two great teams that play really good defense, what at the end of the day is the tipping point? Who gets the edge? And when you have the best player in the world and Giannis Antetokounmpo on your team, that is kind of what gives you the edge over your competition. But they also need to prevent Al Horford from dropping 30, because that's absolutely unacceptable. Al Horford has no business dropping 30. I don't think I've seen Al Horford drop 30 points since he was wearing an Atlanta Hawks uniform. I mean, it has been like probably that long. Like, I want to know, like, I should have looked it up before I came on the show here to give you the exact date, but I can't remember the last time Al Horford dropped 30 points. I mean, that's just, you can't let that happen if you want to be a contending team. But anyways, now to the NFL, specifically your Seattle Seahawks. Mm-hmm. They did not draft a quarterback this year, mm-hmm. which was a shock to many, including myself. I thought they would probably draft Malik Willis in like the second or third round. Didn't end up happening, but there is a veteran quarterback who's still young. And most importantly, he's available in Cleveland, named Baker Mayfield. My question to you is, should the Seahawks go after Baker Mayfield or wait until next season to find their quarterback of the future?
That's your boy, right? before I get into this little spiel of mine, I just wanted to say, just to kind of throw out a stat out there, Al Horford, that was his 132nd playoff game. And I think that was the only game in which he's ever had 30 in a playoff game. So I just kind of want to throw it out there. I could be wrong, though. So if you guys out there, if you're tuned in, definitely be sure to fact check that for me. But going back to your question, I'm going to say no. Unless Cleveland is willing to, one, attach draft capital, or two, take on a significant portion of that $18.85 million salary that he's fully guaranteed for this year. He's going to be 27 years old when the season starts. And I just believe that by trading for him, that signals a win now move. Now, I like what Baker Mayfield brings to the table. I think he's a, I don't know about a franchise quarterback, but he's most definitely a starting quarterback in the NFL. But in Cleveland, he had the coach of the year. He had the best running back duo in football. He had the best offensive line in football. He had playmakers on defense in a Denzel Ward and a Myles Garrett. And that only led to one playoff victory. Now, I'm not holding that against him. I'm not saying that that's his fault, right? But I'm just saying he had literally the perfect team around him, the perfect surrounding around him. And that was the furthest that he was able to take the team. And so what I do know for sure, what I'm getting out of a Baker Mayfield is that he's not going to carry a team, but if the surroundings are adequate, if the surroundings are okay enough, he can get you a playoff victory here or there, but he's not going to be in the driver's seat per se. And so I think in Seattle doesn't have anywhere near the same sort of talent that Cleveland roster had. I mean, yeah, Seattle's offensive line, I think, is much improved. It's getting better. I think the trajectory is definitely pointing upward, but I'm talking about the best offensive line of football in that year, a couple years ago. And you would know about that. The best running back duo. I don't have to get into it again. So I think by bringing in a Baker Mayfield, not only will that limit Seattle and what they can do as far as cap space, just because they already don't have a lot to begin with, or now they don't. And so by bringing him in, you're going to limit what you can do, you know, for the rest of your roster. I think by bringing in a Baker Mayfield, he's an alpha type personality. And I had former KJR Sports radio host on my channel about a month ago, and I asked him the same question: would you want Baker Mayfield in Seattle? And he said emphatically no, because why would Baker Mayfield, an alpha type personality, why would he want to fill in for an alpha like a Russell Wilson? He wouldn't want to play in the shadows of a Russell Wilson. And I just feel like, and this is not his fault, by the way, but Baker Mayfield is going to bring a circus as it pertains to the media to Seattle. And as we all know, Seattle is a very well-run organization, right? They like to keep things in-house, hence why no one knew about the Russell Wilson trade until it happened. It wasn't leaked, even though it was in the process of happening for the last couple of months. No one knew about it. And so with Baker Mayfield coming to Seattle, it's just a bad fit in that regard. He's going to bring a circus. He's going to bring a whole bunch of unwanted attention. He's going to have reporters and media members just clamoring and going after him each and every single week. He doesn't have a very established relationship with the media. He's taking jabs. He's gotten into it back and forth and whatnot. And so I just don't think he's a good fit. I don't think that right now Seattle is a win now position. So you don't make a win now move by trading for him. And I just think he's limited. He's not a franchise quarterback. We know what his ceiling is. And I don't think he can ultimately bring a Super Bowl to the Seattle Seahawks as a starting quarterback. And so unless Cleveland were willing to attach draft capital or pay a significant portion, if not all, of that $18.85 million that he's owed, I'm staying away from him.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the rest of the league agrees with you as well, because I mean, there was rumors of a draft day deal between Carolina and the Cleveland Browns for Baker Mayfield was in place. And all of a sudden that was out of place instantly when they traded up and drafted Matt Corral in the third round. So it doesn't seem that anyone wants Baker Mayfield. And that is that is the most interesting thing in the world to me, because a year ago, this guy was being defended as, okay, he won a playoff game, he's going to be taking the next step. And now it's just so crazy how the NFL, everything can turn on you so quick if you don't perform. And at the end of the day, he had all the weapons and he underperformed. So I think you're right. I think that Seattle is good for not going after Baker Mayfield and looking for the future. Now, the future could be interesting for them, because they might have a quarterback on the roster who could possibly be the future in sort of a long shot kind of way. Pete Carroll had interesting words to say about Drew Lock, who they recently acquired through the Russell Wilson trade with Denver. He claims that Drew Lock would have been the first quarterback taken in this year's draft if he came out of college this year. And honestly, I kind of agree with him. Do you think that Pete Carroll is right, and that Drew Lock would have been the first quarterback taken in this year's draft had he come out of college this year? And if so, if that is true, could he possibly be the Seattle Seahawks quarterback of the future?
Man, there's a lot to unpack with that question. I think with Drew Lock, to answer your first question, I know you want to add a little bit of spiciness. I know you want to add a little bit of flavor to the show, and I'd hate to have to agree, but I got to agree. I mean, yes, I think Drew Lock would have been the first quarterback taken in this year's draft. I mean, when we're looking at the competition, no disrespect to these guys, obviously, relatively speaking, of course, but we're talking about Kenny Pickett, a very raw Malik Willis, a Desmond Ridder, Matt Corral, Sam Howell, Carson Strong, so on and so on and so on. Drew Lock coming out of Missouri, he was highly regarded. I know he went in the second round, but a lot of people were actually looking at Drew Lock as a potential franchise quarterback when he was coming out of the draft. I know his performances in the NFL have kind of overshadowed that, but he still has all the physical tools. He still has the size. He still has the deep ball. He still has the athleticism. And so there are still definitely some traits, athleticism, and a couple of things to kind of like about his game. And so, yes, he struggled in Denver. He struggled immensely. I know he's thrown for, I think, more interceptions than touchdowns. I know he's looked very erratic, especially when thrown under pressure. But, yo, what he's about to have in Seattle, I mean, a DK, a Tyler, arguably the best wide receiver duo in football. You're going to have a ground game spearheaded by Rashad Penny, Ken Walker, and hopefully if he's good enough to come back, or Chris Carson, a much improved offensive line. You're going to have a system that caters to you. And, I mean, keep in mind, his first five games in the NFL, he went 4-1 as a starter. I know the competition might not have been there, and I know that there was a surprise or the element of surprise as it pertains to going up against him, but he definitely still brings a whole lot of potential to the table. And when you look at what he did in Missouri his last year in college, yes, absolutely. I would take him before any of the quarterbacks in this year's draft. Now, as for your second question, is he the future at quarterback? I hate to sound like I'm copping out here, but we're going to have to wait and see. I mean, we got to see what he does in training camp, OTAs, preseason, just because he's working with such, I feel like, the best collection of talent that he's ever had. And so we don't know what he's going to look like with it until we see meaningful snaps. And so until then, it's hard to say that he is the future at quarterback, but I will say this, if he ends up performing admirably, if he ends up, you know, beating out Geno Smith for that job and he looks adequate, if he looks average, then yes, he could very well be the future at quarterback for the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah, I mean, with Drew Lock, it's so interesting because I remember when I had first started this show, I thought Drew Lock that season 2 years ago was going to be like the breakout star of the league. And because he went 4-1 as a starter, just getting thrown into the fire there in Denver, he seemed like he was ready for the moment. And it seemed like the team really rallied around him those last five games. But that season, that last year, just didn't seem like it had that same energy to it and the same feel. Maybe it's because, like you said, the defenses had the chance to prepare for him. But I absolutely think that he would have been the first quarterback taken in this year's draft class because he was great in Missouri. Everyone looked at him like a potential franchise quarterback. I even thought he was a potential MVP candidate. Now, I was wrong.
Oh.
I was wrong. And I'll admit it because, listen, you can go and listen to the old shows. I did say that on the same microphone that I'm speaking into right now. I said that I thought Drew Lock would be in MVP contention last year, but he wasn't. But he still has the talent to be able to, which is why I think it's interesting to kind of bring him in for a year. But I just don't know because now he's been through a couple different head coaches. He's had to learn different systems. He's had to move around. But like you said, all the weapons are there for him to succeed in Seattle and try to re-image himself as a potential franchise quarterback in this league. So it'll be interesting to see. But back to this year's rookie class, what do you make of this year's rookie class of quarterbacks? Because it doesn't seem like anyone was high on them, especially since went from Kenny Pickett getting drafted 20th overall in round one to no one being drafted in the second round, all the way up until Desmond Ridder was drafted by Atlanta in the third round. So it doesn't seem like anyone, even the GMs or the teams, are really high or willing to overdraft for these quarterbacks this year, which is not a trend that we've seen in years past. Will any of them even start in week one? And do you see any of these quarterbacks being career starters in this league? And if so, who do you see being that guy?
So this is going to come off as an indictment on these rookie quarterbacks, but yes, I'm actually, and before I even get into that whole aspect to answer your question, yes, I think week one, there's two quarterbacks, two rookie quarterbacks that have the best shot amongst all of them to start come week one. I think for one, Pittsburgh's Kenny Pickett. I'm just not sold on Mitchell Trubisky. And I'm not saying he's going to start week one because he's some sort of can't miss prospect. I'm not going to go that far, but we just don't know what we're going to get out of a Mitchell Trubisky. I mean, yes, he spent 1 year as a backup, you know, in Buffalo backing up a Josh Allen, but all of a sudden we're just going to overlook what he did and didn't do his first 4 years in the league. I don't know if that's going to go away. And so I think Kenny Pickett, by that alone, I guess in a way, almost by default, has a shot to start week one. Another quarterback that I have my eyes on come week one. A lot of people might be surprised by this, but Matt Corral for the Panthers, obviously barring a trade for a Baker Mayfield. Sam Darnold, I'm sorry, but at the NFL level, it's just he's not it. You know, and last year he had a blazing start to the year. What was he? Started 3-0. His touchdown to INT ratio was solid. The team was winning football games. Obviously, Christian McCaffrey was healthy, and then once Christian McCaffrey went down, the wheels kind of fell off. But Sam Darnold just he's just not that guy. He's not it. And outside of him, I mean, the only other quarterback option for the Panthers is a Matt Corral. And so I don't know what we're going to get out of a Matt Corral, but I think these two quarterbacks definitely have the best shot to start come week one. But as it pertains to the whole class in and of itself, I just don't see star written on any of these quarterbacks. Now, I think Malik Willis does have the high ceiling, which has been talked about ad nauseum because of his athleticism, obviously his traits, you know, his tools, his skill set, what he brings to the table from, you know, an athletic standpoint, from a talent and a leadership perspective. But when it comes to throwing the football, I mean, he's just so raw in that regard. I mean, I know this isn't a Seahawks-based show, but there was a Seahawks report, or there was a report coming out of Seahawks camp just a couple of days ago, and they talked about how none of the Seahawks draft personnel believed in a Malik Willis. They thought that he was too raw and that he was nowhere near ready to play in the NFL. And so if a quarterback needy team like my Seattle Seahawks looked at Malik Willis in that regard, then I'm curious to see how other teams would have looked at a Malik Willis, hence the slip all the way to the third round. And so I think Tennessee's definitely getting a good one, but he's going to need a lot of seasoning. He's going to need a lot of coaching. He's going to need a whole lot of talent around him to really optimize what he can do in the NFL. But outside of that, I just don't see superstar written on any of these guys. I'm not saying that they're going to be scrubs. I'm not saying that they're going to be busts. I mean, at best, they could all be average starters. They could all be above average starters. They could all be like a Baker Mayfield. But I don't see any future all pros. I don't see superstars. I don't see any gold jacket type of guys.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see any kind of like Josh Allen prospects or like anyone that has that high of a ceiling. Like, yes, Malik Willis has a high ceiling, but how high is it? How high is that ceiling really? Because I don't think anyone else thinks that it's really that high. Because like you said, there's quarterback needy teams out there. They didn't really need to draft a quarterback early this year. They waited. And that is not a trend that we've seen in years past. Teams would reach for quarterbacks. Why? Because of positional value, because they're quarterbacks, because you need to have a good quarterback in order to have a good team. And they still slept on all these guys. I think that just shows them that has to be a slap in the face to just all of them saying, you guys just weren't that good this year. But last year's class was something else. Last year's class saw five quarterbacks go in the first round, and even Davis Mills, who ended up being a pretty solid starter last year, was drafted in, I believe, the late second or third round from the Houston Texans. Which quarterback is going into their second year now that you think will have a breakout season this year? Because there's been a lot of talk around what the Jets have done with Zach Wilson. There's been a lot of talk around the Jaguars hiring Doug Peterson. And now the Bears getting a new head coach. A lot of these quarterbacks are in different situations than they were last year. Who is poised to have a breakout year, in your opinion?
Man, great question, Peyton. I think this one's tough. You know, I'm kind of torn between the first two picks from last year, Trevor Lawrence and Zach Wilson. And I think when I'm looking at who has the better team, it got to be the Jets. But I think from a pure talent perspective I can't even say Trevor Lawrence trumps Zach Wilson like that, but I'm going to go with Trevor Lawrence. I know that's the easy answer, but I'm going to shift away from Zach Wilson. I'm going to say Trevor Lawrence. I think with Urban Meyer now out of town, that's addition by subtraction in and of itself, just like that. And so with him out of town, you expect Trevor Lawrence to just, you know, take a leap forward just with that alone. And I know he's not a number one receiver. I know he hasn't had a 1,000-yard season in his career, and I know him and his agent are also responsible for kind of, you know, erupting the wide receiver market. But Christian Kirk is definitely an upgrade over what they had in the receiving corps last year. Now, if I was Jacksonville, I would have addressed receiver in the draft, which I'm very perplexed by. Like, why wouldn't you address receiver for your transcendent generational type prospect at quarterback. That just didn't make sense. Like, why stop adding weapons for him, right? I didn't get that at all. But then again, I'm not running the draft for the Jacksonville Jaguars. But I think with Trevor Lawrence, you also have the return of a Travis Etienne, whom he displayed excellent chemistry with in college. I think he's actually going to be his second or third best receiver this year. I mean, outside of a Christian Kirk, Marvin Jones is a reliable veteran. Laviska Shenault hasn't lived up to his promise. And I'm just not very sure about their receiving core. They let DJ Chark go, but I think Trevor Lawrence, he just has the talent. I mean, there's a reason why he went number one overall. And I think with the Doug Peterson coming in, he's a quarterback whisperer. You know, we saw the best of Carson Wentz under the tutelage of a Doug Peterson, who never should have been fired as the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles. He was very responsible, or he was partially responsible, you know, for Philadelphia bringing home a Super Bowl title a couple years ago. I think he's a quarterback whisperer. I think he's definitely an offensive mastermind. I think he definitely knows what he's doing with quarterbacks and offensive scheming and whatnot. And so I think he's going to help Trevor Lawrence kind of show everyone why he was drafted number one overall, even if the talent or even if the weapons and at the skill positions and even if the defense isn't fully up to par. He also does play in probably the weakest division of football in the AFC South. And I think ultimately that kind of gives him the edge over Zach Wilson.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff. Personally, myself, I would take Zach Wilson. I feel like what they're doing in that offense, Mike LaFleur's offense has a way of, when you get speedy receivers on the team, finding people to get in underneath routes, to get an open space across the middle. That just stems from Shanahan's offense in San Francisco and from his dad's prior to him even. And with that offense, his second year, I feel like it's going to be dynamic. And I feel like through the draft, they got way better. But I also wouldn't be surprised if Trevor Lawrence did take that next step next year, because there's a reason why he was head and shoulders the number one pick going into that draft, especially with such great competition and great talent facing him in that draft class. It wasn't like he was just the only good quarterback in that year's class. There was tons of them. And he was still easily the number one overall pick versus the rest of them. So that wouldn't surprise me at all. But like I said, Steezy, like I said at the beginning when I first brought you on, it's great having you on, man. I want to thank you for coming on. But first, tell everybody watching and listening where they can find you and what you've got coming up next.
Hey, my guy Peyton, bro, again, it's been an honor. It's been a pleasure. Definitely overdue. Like I said before we hopped on air, it's great to see you back in the game, man. It definitely brings a smile to my face. You're definitely somebody I want to keep working with. And, you know, to everyone out there, please, if you aren't already, show my brother some love, man. Hit that subscribe, hit that like, wherever you're tuned in. Definitely be sure to drop a comment, 5 stars, whatever. But give him a follow at PD Sports. I don't know if it's the same handle for everything, but please definitely be sure to do that before you. And then once you do that, then you can find me at Steezya Smith, Steezya Smith. I primarily cover the Seahawks and the NFL, but you'll definitely see a whole bunch of NBA content, boxing content. I'm trying to get into baseball as well. I'm primarily on YouTube, but definitely been trying to pick up the slack on Twitter and Instagram. So be sure to give me a follow on there as well.
All right, bro. Yep. Thank you so much for the kind words, man. It's great. Just gassing me up, bro. But yes, please make sure to follow Steezya Smith on all social media, and make sure to click the link down below in the description that will have his channel. And you can go view that great stuff that he posts. He posts great content for his viewers. I know if you guys are big Seahawks fans or big in the Seattle area, you are going to love him. And thank you again, Steezy, for coming on. And we'll make sure to keep in touch, bro.
Yes, sir. Always. God bless you.
Yeah, you too, bro. All right. Yeah, listen, it was great having Steezy on. It's always great. It's always a pleasure. He's a great guest to have on. Please make sure to go check out his work. He posts a lot of Seahawks content, but he also does a lot of NBA videos. And he talks about the other major NFL news going on as well on his channel. So make sure to check him out. Show him some love. He is well deserving of it. He works very hard, and we're going to continue to work together in the future. So click the link in the description below. The link to his channel is right there, and go hit the subscribe button. Help him out. All right, it's time to finish off the show with what has become what a kind of a weekly segment here on the show, because I have tons of fun doing this. Biggest winners and biggest losers of the week. Starting off with the winner's circle first. The third biggest winner of the week for me is Nikola Jokic. This week, the Joker became the 13th player to win back-to-back MVPs in NBA history. And to those of you saying that he is undeserving, Here is why I think you're wrong. Jokic averaged 27 points, 13.8 rebounds, and 7.9 assists per game, which is absolutely insane to think about given the position that he plays. He led the league in triple doubles this year, which again is absolutely insane to do at the center position. He also was the first player ever to surpass 2,000 points, 1,000 boards, and 500 assists in a single season. So obviously, he had a historic regular season. He did things that no one else has ever done. And while playoffs don't matter for this award, but to those of you who think it does, he averaged 31 points and 13 rebounds per game in the playoffs this year. He also did all of this while his team was missing their two best players in Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. for the majority of this season. So I'd say the MVP was well-deserved for Jokic, and that is a big win. Congrats to the Joker. At number two, I have Josh Naylor, first baseman for the Cleveland Guardians. On Tuesday night, the Guardians were trailing the White Sox 8-4 in the ninth inning. Naylor is at the plate with the bases loaded, and this is what he does.
Doesn't want this one to end just yet. Oh. Naylor with a high drive. It is deep. It is gone. A grand slam for Josh Naylor. He jumps Liam Hendricks, and we're tied at 8 in the ninth.
How about this?
What a great moment. You step up to the plate and crush a grand slam to send the game to extra innings. But wait, it gets even better. Here we are, top of the 11th, tied at 9 apiece. Josh Naylor is at the plate again with runners on first and second, and watch what happens.
He clobbers another one. Deep right field. Back his angle. He's out. Yes, indeed. A grand slam in the ninth. A three-run homer with two out in the 11th.
Boy, has this guy been just money. Look
and
at him.
Eight RBI night.
Look at him.
Oh, man, look out. Get out of his way.
Naylor crushes a homer again to right field to win the game for Cleveland in the 11th inning, and afterwards goes absolutely crazy in the dugout. He tosses his helmet while screaming, "I want all the smoke." He wasn't lying. And it gets even better than that. Not only did Josh Naylor hit a grand slam in the ninth to send the ball game to extras, not only did he hit a three-run home run in the 11th inning to win the game, not only did he have an incredible celebration, Josh Naylor also became the first player in the history of Major League Baseball to hit 8 RBIs or more in the 8th inning or later. So way to step up when it matters most for your team. Major win for a huge historic night for Josh Naylor. But the biggest winner of the week has to be Tom Brady. Fox Sports is handing Tom Brady a major bag to be a lead sports analyst for them whenever he feels like he's ready to retire. Tom Brady's deal with Fox Sports is reportedly 5 years worth $375 million. That is more than he's made in his entire NFL career combined. What a major flex this is from the GOAT. Tom's just like, he's sitting there just like, yeah, NFL, it's been real, but I've got Fox Sports ready to pay me $375 million just like whenever I feel like retiring. That's GOAT stuff right there. The fact that he's going to make more in 5 years in the broadcast booth than he has in 22 years of being the greatest quarterback to ever touch a football field is quite remarkable. What a win. And on top of that, he doesn't have to deal with the wife and kids at home after he retires. Those few months off must have tormented Tom, because not only did he return to his old job that he just left to spend time with family, he found his next job. He's searching for his next job and found it before he's even ready for that next job. He does not want to be at home anymore. He wants to still be working. Tom's an active guy. I'm sure it drove him nuts to be at home, retired for a month. So good job to Tom Brady for getting that bag. And all those pay cuts that he's taken throughout his NFL career are certainly paying off. All right, but now with every winner, there is a loser. So here's the loser list of the week. Starting off, I have the Memphis Grizzlies. The Grizzlies have lost Ja Morant for at least the rest of this series against the Warriors. And now after losing the last two games, they find themselves in a 3-1 hole in the Western Conference semifinals. And now they have to find a way to climb out of it without the best player on their team. Things are not looking good for Memphis. But overall, I still want to give them credit on a great season. Nobody expected the Grizzlies to be this good, so congrats to them. And let's also wish Ja Morant a speedy recovery because he truly became a superstar this season, and it's never good to see any player get hurt, let alone one of the NBA's finest. So congrats to Memphis on a great season. It's tough the way you guys are going out, and I wish Ja Morant a speedy, speedy recovery. Now at number two, I have Rudy Gobert. So basically this week, Shaq was on a podcast. I'm not quite sure which one, but Shaq ended up saying that Rudy Gobert wouldn't have been able to guard him back in his prime. Shaq claims he'd be able to score 12 points on Gobert in just 3 minutes, which I think is a fair statement to say because Rudy Gobert is like one of the most mid players in the NBA, and prime Shaq was one of the most unstoppable forces in the history of all of sports. But I guess Rudy Gobert didn't think so because he commented on the post saying, and I quote, "I would eat his bleep clean." And for those of you who don't know what the bleep is, it's the behind word. First of all, that's a strange way to put it. But besides that, no, you wouldn't, Rudy. Everyone in the world knows you wouldn't stand a chance against the Big Diesel. In fact, around Twitter and social media, nobody wholeheartedly is on Gobert's side in this situation. Ever since Gobert fleeced the Jazz of over $200 million, all I've heard was him telling us how great he is, rather than him showing us how great he is, which has to be a major L, which is why he is on this list. At number one, the biggest loser of the week, he's sitting here talking into this microphone as we speak. I have myself, Peyton Doyle. Why not just take the time to poke a little bit of fun at myself here, because I certainly deserve it. If any of you follow me on Twitter at Peyton Doyle Show, you would have seen what I had posted about the Miami Heat following their game 4 loss in Philly. I said this, and this is a literal quote that came out of my fingertips onto my Twitter account. Philly ties the series at 2 apiece. Am I surprised? Absolutely not. The only thing I'm surprised about is how the Heat weren't a play-in team at best. I also went on to This Just In on Monday night and ripped the Heat and said that I'm taking the 76ers to win the series in 6 games. And as I mentioned earlier, the Heat went out in game 5 and absolutely mopped Philly off the floor in a 35-point blowout. That's tough. I totally missed on that take. I can't lie, which is why I'm going to have to bear this L for the rest of the week because I ended up being the biggest loser on my own show. How does that even happen? All right, but that's going to be it for today, guys. Thank you all so much for watching and or listening. If you haven't already, please make sure to like, follow, and or subscribe wherever you may be listening. I hope you all have a blessed week and make sure to stay tuned for next week's episode. Thank you so much.